News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Big football game tonight in Lincoln, Nebraska. The Bulldogs and Cornhuskers kick off at 4, and our pregame coverage starts right after this show. But we're going to talk a little baseball in Hometown Heroes today. We're joined by a guy who's been a ball player, he's been a chiropractor, and he's been a decorated World War II veteran. A story that not too many people can tell. If you've ever researched or learned anything about the Battle of the Bulge, one of the big flashpoints and one of the rallying points for American troops is something known as the Malmedy Massacre. And our guest today had an up-close view of some of the circumstances around that. He was decorated for his actions during that time in December of 1944, and we're going to get that story today from Dr. E.J. Leatherman of Clovis, California. He's 88 years old, spent some of his early years in Fresno as a heralded ball player for the Roosevelt High Rough Riders. And I'm guessing you're a teenager, you're playing with guys much older than you and having great success. Read one article, your first year in the Twilight League, you're hitting 429, playing shortstop. You played with some terrific names over the years, and something tells me that you probably had aspirations of making baseball a career. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's true. From the time I was a young lad, I only dreamt of being a professional baseball player, and I devoted almost all my spare time into practicing and playing, and was able to be associated with some very good returning professional baseball players back to Fresno before we had professional baseball come into Fresno.
Right. So, and you were on the first professional baseball team in Fresno. So in high school, you're winning Valley Championships with the Rough Riders of Roosevelt. And then you had an opportunity to sign to play professional ball. Was there any hesitation there for you to become a pro ball player?
No, that was my ambition all my life, so I was very elated. They gave me a contract, and they paid me $75 a month. Compared to prices nowadays, that's nothing, but I would pay them to play. I love baseball so much.
And that was with the Fresno Cardinals?
That was with the Fresno Cardinals for the first year they came into Fresno.
How big of a deal? Because now, I mean, we have the Fresno Grizzlies downtown and the AAA Pacific Coast League. They've had some big crowds at the end of their season. We certainly have the Fresno State Diamond Dogs and their national championship a few years ago. And you go all the way back to Pete Biden there. But how big a deal was that for Fresno at the time to have the Cardinals here and a professional team in Fresno?
I think it was a great attribute for Fresno and all the athletes here that participated in baseball and athletics and in a whole field. But it was the start of professional ball here. And from the first game, they were successful. Fresno turned out and supported them very well.
And you were playing shortstop?
At that time, I was playing third.
And that was 1941? Was that the first year of that team?
That's correct. That's when they started.
So 1941, and spring turns to summer, and you're playing baseball, and you're getting paid to play baseball, and you're doing this every day. And after the season, once December rolls around, things changed for just about everybody in the world. Do you remember December 7th, 1941, and how you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I was traveling down Belmont Avenue close to downtown district at Safeway store where I worked. It was a Sunday, as I recall, and I went in to just to check up and see if everything was in order that from Saturday business. And I heard on the radio about the attack in the islands. It didn't concern me that much at that time. I was naive and I was young, and I thought maybe it'll last maybe 6 months or a year. What did I know about war?
You were going to learn, that's for sure. So that's December 7th, 1941, and you're thinking, hey, I'm just going to keep on playing baseball. And for a while, you did. In fact, you even made it up to the Pacific Coast League and the Sacramento Solons?
That's correct. When I got to Sacramento, we had an in-house ball game going, and I had I was playing second at that time. And as I was going over to cover on a steal, the guy slid into me and hit me just as the baseball got to me, and it hit my index finger on my right hand, smashed the two bones together in the middle of my finger, and it is stiff, just about as stiff today as it was then. It ended my really professional baseball career with that broken finger.
And tell me about your manager in Sacramento, because that's a name that some people might recognize if they know their baseball history, a World Series hero from the 1930s.
Pepper Martin, I met him in Southern California at spring training camp, and Pepper was quite a unique individual, but he emphasized to me the fact that you don't miss balls. You either catch them with your glove or you catch them with your chest. You stop the ball and you pick it up and you throw it. And his chest was always black and blue to indicate that that's the way he played ball. And I was enthusiastic about it. I played with that kind of attitude pretty much after that when I got into the military. I played in several championship teams. I always did pretty good at my batting average, but when I threw the ball, you couldn't tell where it was going to stop because of that crooked finger. And so the people over on first base, they would duck whenever I started to throw from third.
You talk about throwing wildly and they'd have to duck, but I didn't hear duck as one of your nicknames. I did hear they called you Junior, or they called you Juice. Where did the Juice nickname come from?
Well, that's kind of interesting. One day when I was a senior in high school, I was across the street at Pete Hills when we were getting ready to go back into the school building after lunch. I was walking along and they were kidding me about the fact that I was signing up to play professional baseball. They said, you know, Junior, you have to learn how to chew tobacco if you're going to be a baseball player in the big leagues. And all the big league baseball players chew tobacco. And I said, well, I don't think so. And they said, yeah, here, I got a plug of it right here. Just take a little sip and try this and you'll find out it'll make you a better player. So I took a bite off of that chunk of tobacco and I was chewing away and all of a sudden my stomach started to bother me and I looked back behind me and Hurley, the dean of boys, was right behind me, so I couldn't spit it out. I couldn't do anything. And he stayed right behind us till we got to the front door of the Roosevelt High School. So I knew I couldn't go any further, so I ran over into the bushes there by the door, and I vomited up, and I was sick, and I laid there. But Hurley had gone in, and he didn't see me go into that bush. So after a while, I went back in. I finally got to my classroom. Just so happened I was seated next to my sweetheart at that time, Virginia Trower, and she looked at me, and she said, your face is awfully white. What's the matter? And I said, well, I don't know. I think I'm going to have to throw up. So Mrs. Hurley heard that. She was right there in front of us. That was our teacher. She said, Junior, you go get yourself taken care of. You're in bad shape. So I said, I need a slip. She said, no, don't wait for a slip. And so I ran down the hall, and I came to the first restroom I could, and it happened to be women's. But nobody was in there, but I went in, and I threw up, and from then on, they call me Juice, so that's where I got my nickname.
That doesn't sound like very tasty juice, and I guess the follow-up question is, did you ever try chewing tobacco again?
No, I never did.
Smart man. And you did play plenty more baseball, so apparently that bill of goods they were trying to sell you was exactly that. You talked about playing more ball when you got into the military, but we haven't heard how you ended up in the military. Were you drafted, or was this your own decision?
No, I was drafted. I was pretty happy I had just gotten married 6 months prior to when I got my draft notice, and I was working in the shipyards as an assistant leaderman, and with a name like Leatherman and being a leaderman, I was flying in high clouds, and the big salary, my wife and I were very happy together, and I wanted to keep that life going forever, but the military said they needed me. I wasn't sure that they really did. But as it turned out, I had a lot of experiences in the military that helped me in the future life.
Well, we're going to hear about some of those. And while we're on the baseball theme, let's talk about the baseball you played in the military. Because just the magic of the internet, I typed in your name and popped up something that in August of 1943, playing with the Camp Chaffee, Arkansas team, the 1850th Service Unit baseball team, you were part of a historic ball game where that team beat the KFPW broadcasters 15-0, and a crafty left-hander threw a no-hitter that day, striking out 17. That left-hander happens to be the guy who won more major league games than any other left-hander in history, the guy they called Spawny, Warren Spahn. What do you remember about playing with him on that base team in Arkansas?
That one balls game, that's the only time I got to play with him. But later on, when I was in, or I'd heard about him when I was in St. Louis, they were working on my finger trying to help get it in shape so I could continue to be a professional baseball player. And it never did come around, but on one occasion, this team came into town to St. Louis, and the starting pitcher was Warren Spahn, and all the people in the audience, they were kind of deriding his name, and I can understand it because my real first name is Elwin, and I was kind of kidded the same way, but he was Warren, and so they would all go, Warren, Warren, kind of deriding that name, but he always pitched the game and always won every time I saw him pitch.
And you saw him before he became the Major League All-Star and Hall of Famer that he was. So could you tell in that game, watching him throw a no-hitter, that he was going to be something special in the big leagues? Because you had that experience in the minors yourself already.
Yes. The thing that stood out for me is that because they were deriding him so much, he must be good. And the fact was he wasn't a big person. He wasn't a heavy person. He was slender like I was, but he was taller. But he could throw that ball, and he was crafty. He could throw it all kinds of pitches. I knew he was going to be good, but I didn't know that he would go to the extreme that he did, eventually become one of the biggest, greatest left-handed hitters in the name of baseball.
Absolutely, and he too was a decorated World War II veteran. Warren Spahn, who died in 2003, received a Bronze Star, a Purple Heart, and was actually promoted during his service to second lieutenant. So he had a distinguished war record. On the wall of Dr. Leatherman's home in Clovis, you will see a Bronze Star from the American military, also the Croix de Guerre from the French government, and a very special medal from the British as well that we're going to talk about. But I want to just get a sense for what it was like for you to enter the military and have to say goodbye to your wife, because you haven't been married even a year, and now you don't know if maybe you might not even ever see her again. You're heading off to war.
That's true, but that happened to millions of other people just like me, the other soldiers. So I figured if they could handle it, I'd handle it. I did on one occasion get homesick for my wife to the point that I wasn't a commissioned officer. I was a non-com corporal. But the rules were that you couldn't have your wife come to camp. When I got to Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, I knew I had to have her come and live with me or come and see if I could get her there. So I called her on the phone, and she was elated that if I could do that, she'd be happy to come. So I found a couple that said that if my wife came, they would let us live with them. Their name was Martins, Mr. and Mrs. Martin. So I called Virginia and told her that I had it all arranged, and I told her how to get to Arkansas. As a big occasion for her, a young girl, going clear across to Arkansas was a big occasion. So anyway, she got there, and she came to all our baseball games. She was acquainted with the staff sergeant for our battalion and his wife, and she took Virginia under her arm, treated her like her sister. And so she had a very good experience in Arkansas as well as I did.
Yeah, sounds like you would have loved to stay at Camp Chaffee for a while, but I'm sure the Army, and more specifically the 526th Armored Infantry Battalion, had other plans for you. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, at that point, I had been in a trucking company, and I had gone through basic training twice and in Camp Polk, Louisiana. And then we came to Arkansas, and from Arkansas then, they gave us a choice. They said, we're disbanding the trucking company. You have your choice. There are a lot of you people that are from California. One of the choices is you can go to a camp that's just out of Los Angeles, and understand they get to go home quite often and into Los Angeles itself. And they have to be able to drive half tracks. And you're all qualified that have already completed their truck driving sequences. So we all that wanted to go, of course, we held up our hands and we came, and they put us on these trains. It took us about 5 days to get from Arkansas back over to Lone Corner, California, into Camp House, Arizona. And when we got there, the train stopped, and we piled out, and they said, "This is your home." And the train took off. They piled off a bunch of building materials. And so after Chuck was gone, they said, "These are your tents. We're going to be, we have facilities here with our trucks to haul them out in the desert. We'll be out in the desert about 4 or 5 miles from here, and we'll be setting up our camp." So that's what happened. They took us over there in the desert and dumped us off. And most of us never put up a pup tent, let alone we had these six-man tents, big, six people in each tent. Took us forever. We slept on the ground until we got our tents done. As it turned out, I hated it, but now as I reflect back on it, it was just an experience of a life that I'll never forget. And it was interesting. Met all these great guys that were in the same boot I was in, and if they could survive it, I could survive it.
Well, and you've survived quite a bit in your 88 years. We're going to hear some more of that when we come back. After the break, we're going to get into his deployment overseas in Europe during World War II. We're going to talk about the Battle of the Bulge and, yes, the Malmedy Massacre. He was captured, but he's still alive. How did that all happen? We're going to get the story and hear why he was decorated for his actions back in December of 1944. Dr. E.J. Leatherman, 88 years old, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and I have three words for you. Ready? Duration, premium, cool. Duration, premium, cool roofing shingles from Owens Corning Roofing come with state-of-the-art reflective granules that lower the amount of solar energy entering your home. That means your AC may not have to work so hard, resulting in an energy bill that will go the only direction you ever want it to go, down. I did it. You can, too. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration, premium, cool at a Pacific Supply location near you. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships, and now one of its football coaches is former All-Pro quarterback Daryl LaMonica. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 88-year-old E.J. Leatherman, a doctor, a chiropractor. Maybe he worked on your back once upon a time in Fresno or Clovis. Maybe you can still feel those strong hands like I felt when I shook his hand today, showing up at his house to interview him. He's got some great photos of his days as a ball player and his days in the military. If you want to look at some of those, you can go to kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, where we're more than 300 strong now following that. Let's go back now to the 1940s. He talked about his ball-playing career, and then the military had other ideas for him. He's married. And he's going to have to head overseas and kiss that wife of his goodbye. What was that goodbye like when you had to ship out for Europe?
It was a terrible day for me to say goodbye to my lovely wife. But the other men in my outfit were confronted with the same situation. So we were just looking forward to what's going to happen next. And you never knew. Things just changed so rapidly. But we got on a ship called Queen Mary. And we went from there to Wales, and we got into Wales. We had a secret outfit that they put us in out in the desert. We had tanks. They were lit up with bright lights and 13 million candle power lights, and they would light up and blind the enemy. And of course, if you did that and you scared the enemy, they'd jump up and run, and you would shoot them. But it didn't work out that way. But we practiced. That's the way we did in the desert. We worked nights because the days were 120, and the lights only worked for us when it was dark. So during that time, we had to practice out in the desert and with the scorpions and all the snakes and everything else. But we survived, and we lived through the pup tents and our regular tents. And the food, when the sand blew, the food was pretty sandy on several occasions. But when we got on the Queen Mary to go across the ocean, I had a fellow, I told him I got sick every time I went fishing in Mendota on just a little tiny boat. So I was afraid about what was going to happen to me on the Queen Mary. He says, let me take care of you. You won't get hurt at all. Every time he saw me along the rails, looked like I might be getting sick, he would take me in, grab my hand and say, let's go get something to eat. I'm not hungry. Come on. You just grab my belt. Hold on to my belt. So I said, well, that's too big a crowd. I can't stand in that crowd. He said, don't worry about it. So when we get to the ramps going down to the cafeteria, lined up with all these military people, not moving, he'd holler, look out. Ooh. And he'd act like he was going to vomit and they'd duck out of the way, and he'd go down those stairs, and I was holding on to him. He'd get me clear down to the cafeteria. We would be the first in line, and we'd get food. And then to get back, he'd do the same thing. Everybody would duck and get out of the way because they're afraid we're going to mess them up. And along the rails, from then on, all the way across the ocean, he'd find somebody along the rails, and he'd get on one side, and I'd be on the other side. And he'd say, man, you're looking kind of gray. Do you feel like you're going to be able to vomit? What's happening to you? And pretty soon the guy would start to vomit, and then he'd start laughing, and we'd go down the rail to the next one. That's how he kept me laughing almost all the way across the ocean, and I never once got sick on that trip.
That's something. As far as the goodbye with Virginia, did you two make at each other any kind of pledges or promises, or were you afraid to say too much? Did you just have to look at each other's eyes? I don't want to be melodramatic here, but I mean, this seems like a pretty big moment.
Well, it was for me because this little girl, I first met her when she was in the second grade and I was in the third, and I was in love with her sister. We knew each other for all those years, and then when we got to high school, we lived close together, and so we walked to school about 5 or 6 blocks every day to Roosevelt from the time she was 14 until I graduated from high school. My best friend and brother-in-law was her brother, probably well known by a lot of people here in Fresno, Don Jeep Trower. He played for San Francisco Seals. And so I was marrying into a baseball family, and they were all beautiful people in that family. And so we knew each other. Virginia and I knew each other so well, we didn't have to really speak about a lot of things like most people would, because we already knew everything that was going on. But it was heartbreaking to see the smile on her face when she said goodbye. I admit I had tears in my eyes when I kissed her goodbye, and she had tears in hers. But I said, all right, often. And as it turned out, we wrote almost every day. They had V-mails in those days, this little piece of paper you could write, just bare short notes. We consistently wrote V-mails back and forth, and she saved them. And she had 2 cardboard boxes full of them when I got home.
Oh, boy. Those are the treasures. And I want to, if we have time, I hope we can get back to that training in the desert with the top secret weapon of the super bright light, because I think that's intriguing and something other people haven't heard. But I don't want to miss out on what happened in Europe for you. So let's get to that first. When did you get over to France? And how soon was it before what I guess would be the defining moment of your time over there in December of 44? Did you get over in June or July?
Yeah, it was in August, and we went straight through France. The Germans were pretty well beaten up there when we came across the ocean and landed there at the beachhead. That broke their backs, and Patton just kept after them and going. We could have gone a lot faster, but you couldn't keep up with the gas. We had to have petroleum in order to keep going. But we went clear through to Paris, Verdun, and then they sent us separately to Chateaux in Belgium. And we were too big an outfit for any kind of facilities they had over there. So they separated us up into chateaux. They're just like little castles. So we were there for several months. I had a lot of different experiences. Played ball there too. on the 15th of December, they came through and they said, take everything that you can carry with you that's important. Anything else, we're going to burn it or bury it or give it to the people around here. So that's what we did. And next morning, we took off in a column of all the half-tracks and all our personnel. We had 1,500 men in our battalion. As we were going down this road, I heard this sound above my head behind me, and it sounded like a 6x6 truck up there in the sky. I look back, and here's this German pilot. I can see him just as plain. He's a little young guy. He looked like probably about 20 years old, and he had this fighter pilot. So he cut loose with a burst of ammo, and it came along our left side on the dirt, and then he cut across. He was swinging back and forth because he was afraid we were going to get our machine gun set up and knock him out of the sky. But he got away before we could dismount and get all of our machine guns set up for him. But that introduced us to the Battle of Bulge. That's the first arms that started us on that trek into Malmedy. They said when we get to Malmedy, that'll be the start of the Bulge. And that was true. When we got there, they placed us in a field. And the medics in our group, we stayed at a dairy. The guy owned four cows and had a few of the big milking cans. We used those cans as urinals up in the second floor. And the men, it was all snow and cold. And I stayed in my half track. I made my bedroll with three big blankets, and I curled them back and forth three times. So I had about nine layers of blankets, and man, I laid on the floor in my half track on that iron, and that's where I slept and lived. We were there for several days, and well, about six airplanes came over us, and they were American planes, and these planes were bombers. So we were standing out in the snow waving at them, and all of a sudden they dropped the bombs. The snow was flying. They went in and hit Malmedy, downtown, all over the building there, killed a lot of people. The fact was that the German head honkers had put in a call on the radios that they had captured Malmedy and that they had waiting for the Americans to show up. So our military then sent the aircrafts in, thinking they were going to bomb the Germans there in Malmedy, inadvertently hit some of our people and a lot of the civilians. So that was my occasion of being there. We got orders one day that our B company over in Stavelo was being butchered, and they had a lot of wounded and killed and needed the medics over there to take care of them. So the colonel and I were good friends because he loved baseball, and he always won money when we'd win ball games. But he asked me, he said, would you take some men and get over there and see what you can do for those people? And I said, well, I don't know how to get there. He said, well, just follow the road there. They'll give you a map. We took off on this. We had two ambulances with half tracks, and we had six of us medics. And as we were going along, we were about 6 kilometers out of Malmedy when I noticed a big rig, like something you'd see in a motor pool working on tanks and things like that. But I'd never seen one like this. But in the bottom, in the back, there was a transmission, oil leaking out of it, and there was a fire coming out. So here it is, foggy, can't hardly see anything, and I'm looking at something, big vehicle that's burning. How's it burning in this ice and snow, cold and fog? And just about then, Nelson said, Leatherman, did you see that? And I said, what's that? He said, a command car just went by us with a big swastika on it. I said, hold it, turn it, get this thing off the road, get it over here on the side. Behind us, Brown, who lived in Tulare, he was driving that half track. He pulled over behind us. So just that time, the command car backed up. There was no place they could turn around. It was too narrow and it was too icy. So they backed up and they stopped right across from where we were. They started hollering in German. The guy said, what's he talking about, Leatherman? I said, well, they want us to get out of the half tracks, put our hands over our heads. They want to search us.
You understood German because your parents and grandparents had spoken German all throughout your childhood, right?
That's correct. I didn't know I knew that much German, but it came to me quite rapidly. I had read up in the little book that they give you in the military how to speak French, how to speak German. So during the months we traveled, I did practice my French and my German. The fellas got out and stood there, and the driver, he had a machine gun, and the officers up on this command car had a higher bench built. It was about 3 or 4 feet higher than normal command car. He looked like Hitler, twice as more powerful than Hitler, with this big fancy rig of his. I stayed in my half track and watched this. They lined him up, and the driver searching, and he came to Walters, and he found a Luger pistol in his jacket. Well, the Lugers were for the German officers, so this driver took the pistol out of his pocket and hit him in the head and knocked him down on the ice. He started hollering at the officer, the German officer, and they were going back and forth pretty rapidly, and I thought, oh my God, they're going to kill Walters because you're not allowed as a medic to have arms on you. I kind of sweat that out for a moment. Then I heard the colonel say something to the driver that sounded like artillery. When I saw that they weren't going to kill Walters, I got out of the half track and I started hollering at attention in German. And so they looked at me and they hollered at me, come over here. So I went out in the middle of the road and they said, what are you guys doing here? And I said, we're on our way to Stabilo. I was speaking German as well as I could. They said, why are you going to Stabilo? What's your name of your outfit? How many men do you got? So I told them, we have 1,500 men. We did have 1,500 men, but I told them 2,500. And I said, we have about 50 tanks. We're in Malmedy and we're coming this way. I think you guys ought to get out of here if you don't want to get shot. And they said, what are you going to do in Stabilo? And I said, well, we have to take care of the wounded there. And we take care of the wounded. And I threw in the fact that we also took care of the enemy. Even though they were the enemy, if they were wounded, we took care of them, hoping that this would persuade them to just leave us alone so that we could get out of there. Oh, they started speaking in Blattdeutsch, which is a slang German. Well, on my mother's side, they spoke a lot of Blattdeutsch, so I knew that as well as I did High German. Anyway, I figured out what they were saying is that they would take care of us with the artillery. Don't worry about it. Just leave them alone. The big commander said, you keep your men right here for 15 minutes. If you move before then, we will fire on you with our artillery. And I said, okay, we will stay 15 minutes. So they took off and went down the road as fast as they could. I said, let's get out of here. So we jumped in our half tracks. We started going as fast as we could. We went about, I'd say a half a mile, not even a quarter of a mile. And here came an artillery shell, landed on my side of the road. The snow flew up in the air. The next fire hit on the left side of the road, dismissing our half track. As we traveled on back, going back to Malmedy, and we came to 8 GIs out in the middle of the road. They were waving. We couldn't get by them, so we stopped. They said, what the hell are they doing shooting at the medics? Who is firing on the medics? And they said, let's get out of here. So they started running back towards Malmedy. So we traveled another about a quarter of a mile, came to another little bend in the road, and there was a lieutenant there with about 24 men. He said, what happened back there? What's all that shooting about? Were they firing at you guys? And we said, yeah, but we didn't want to say anything. We told the other group up ahead, and they started running. He says, my group don't run. He said, what happened? So I told him, and he said, holy cow. He said, where are you headed? And I said, we're going back to Malmedy to find out where we're supposed to go, because we're not going that through that road. So we went back to Malmedy, and the colonel and the outfit saw us coming back, so they sent a runner over to where we were in our bivouac area, and he said, Colonel Irwin wants to see you, Leatherman. So I went over there, and he said, what happened? So I told him what happened. Oh, incidentally, when we backed up our half track to turn around by that big rig that was burning, I kept my eyes, my door open, and I was keeping Nelson from getting us stuck in that mud, and I was afraid we might not be able to get out of there. And as we drove back, I saw where we had driven over the leg of a soldier. He was buried underneath that ice and snow by that big rig. So when I told Colonel Irwin about it, well, he said, you did a good job, Leatherman. He said, you saved your two ambulances and you saved five medics. And he said, we need those ambulances to figure out how to get them over to Stabilo. So he congratulated me, and I went back to my quarters. I was there about a half an hour, and they came and said, Colonel wants to see you again. I said, okay. So I went over.
And let's stop it right there, because that second conversation with the colonel would be a real eye-opener. What was the significance of that leg in the snow, and what was E.J. Leatherman about to find out? We'll get those answers when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Rising energy bills got you down? Paul Leffler here telling you to look up. as in look up to the top of your house and put your roof to work for your wallet. I want to tell you about Duration Premium Cool, the Energy Star rated roofing shingles from Owens Corning Roofing and Asphalt. I don't have to tell you how hot California summers can get, but did you know that installing a cool roof can help fend off that heat? You can take your pick from four distinctive colors. We have sage on top of the Leffler home, but what makes Duration Premium Cool shingles so special is the reflective granule technology that basically bounces sunlight back up to the sky so it doesn't get absorbed into your home. Duration Premium Cool shingles are proven to reflect up to 25% of that solar energy targeting your house on a hot summer day. So you may not have to use your AC as much, potentially giving your air conditioner a rest. So don't just get any roof, get an energy efficient cool roof from Owens Corning. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool shingles at a Pacific Supply location near you.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. When we left off with Dr. E.J. Leatherman, he had escaped from German forces and had been credited by his colonel with saving men and valuable equipment. But just 30 minutes later, the colonel wanted to talk to him again.
He said, "We just had a man come in here that saw you guys get captured, and he was up in the hills. They killed 100 GIs yesterday. And he was one of them they shot, and they killed at least 7 medics in the bunch. When they got through shooting these people, they walked around and kicked them, and if they made any sound, they shot them in the head. So he saw him coming while he was lying there, and he gritted himself as hard as he could, and the guy saw all the blood on his shoulder and just stepped over. He didn't want to get it on his shoe, I guess. He said, he's dead. So they went to the next guy and shot him. So after the Germans took off, he crawled out of that pasture, went up the side of the hill, took leaves and limbs off of trees, put them on top of him, so he lived through the night, and he saw us captured, saw the whole thing go on, but he was afraid to holler to us because they'd get him again.
Wow. And if people have never heard of the Malmedy massacre before, they are just getting a picture that you stumbled upon the aftermath of it. And that leg that, as you drove off, you saw under the snow was one of the victims of that horrible German atrocity there, where Americans were just mowed down after they had surrendered. And so now, when you hear this and you find out that just the day before you were there, all these Americans were killed in cold blood by German forces, probably the same Germans who had you captured. When you realized that, what did that do to you?
Well, it was a very scary moment because they undoubtedly would have shot us. But the fact was, when I got out of my half track, I left my door open, thinking that it might impress them that maybe we had some wounded soldiers in our ambulance. When you're wounded, you still keep your arms. So they didn't know but what we have somebody in there with arms that would be able to shoot them. So they were in a position where they had to get away as well as we had to get away. And the fact that this kid, they told us later on, it was 100. They boiled it down to 80. I think the last time I heard it was 87 was the true count of those that was killed, but there was 7 or 8 who did, like the other guy that came there and or happened to see us captured. 7 or 8 other people did the same thing in the other hills. A few people lived, but most of them were slaughtered out there in that pasture. And it was very scary to me to think that these are the guys that captured us. Why didn't they shoot us? Well, they didn't shoot us because they were sitting ducks. For anybody in my half track that had an M1 rifle, could have shot him. So that's why I left the door open to start with. And it worked out real well for us.
But it might not have worked out if you would have followed their orders and stayed for 15 minutes. And I want to read something here and then come back with a few follow-up questions for you. This was from the British government. It says, on 18th December 1944, Corporal Leatherman, operating a medical half track near Stavelot, Belgium, got behind the German lines and was stopped, searched, and made to leave his vehicle. He deceived the German officer as to our strength, went back to his vehicle, and drove it off under close scrutiny from the Germans and other personnel. His courage and resourcefulness not only saved his vehicle and possibly the lives of his fellow soldiers, but kept the ambulance to evacuate wounded men badly in need of attention. So this is an addition to your Bronze Star from the U.S. military, to the Croix de Guerre from the French. The British government gave you this medal, and it was actually presented to you not long after that by a name that I think people would recognize. Who was it that pinned that medal on you?
That was the general of the British Army, Montgomery. He came through Wiesbaden, Germany. After the war was over, he came through and decorated me and Major Solis with the medal from the British government, which was a very big honor for me. And then the French army gave me the French Croix de Guerre with the Ecole de Bronze, that means with the Bronze Star. That means you have two medals of that. And then the Bronze Stars, I had one for that occasion of the capture, and I had another one for another episode, and then I was given another Bronze Star for the fact that when the war was over, they gave all the riflemen in the American Army who fought in the war, they gave them Bronze Stars. So the military soldiers said, what about the medics? And they said, well, if we deserve them, the medics deserve the Bronze Stars also, so they did give all the medics who were in combat the Bronze Star. So that's why I have three Bronze Stars.
In this occasion in particular, 18th of December of 44, to have the armies of three different countries recognize that what you did was significant and worth noting, that's pretty special. But I'm curious how much you've thought about it since then. And if I say, well, if you had agreed to stay for 15 minutes, like the Germans asked you to do, do you think you would be here talking to me today?
No, there's no doubt about it that they had their artillery set up for that. It's called Cross Points, is the actual place of the slaughter of Malmedy. They had it zeroed in. That's how they came so close, because they couldn't see us. It was too much fog, but they came very close to us. So they would have got us for sure if circumstances weren't what they were under that occasion. We were very fortunate. We knew it as soon as we brought in that prisoner from off that hill. We knew that we were just very fortunate. And I thank my Heavenly Father for saving my life. I've been saved at least 12 times in my lifetime. And so there has to be somebody else that's helping you on these occasions. And for me to speak the German that I spoke that day was a revelation to me. It's a good thing to learn another language, but I never thought that the German language would ever benefit me to that degree.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying that in the heat of the moment, you were able to communicate in a way that you probably didn't think you could. You didn't think you knew German that well to be able to do that. But in that moment, as the adrenaline's pumping, as everything's going on, it sounds like the words just came to you.
That's true. That's a remarkable part about a brain. It can retain things that you don't even know you have. You ask me if I ever think about this, and that's the one occasion that capture is the one thing that comes to light very often in the middle of the night, and I think, well, what should I have done? What could I have done? How come I did it that way? And the one thing I thought of, I think of more often than anything, is if they would have shot Walters, I would have fired up my half track, and I'd charged straight across the road, because they could not turn around, and I'd have crashed into that command car. I could have crushed them back into that snowbank, and maybe we could have come out without losing anybody either. It's just things like that, but I get upset because I can't sleep. What good does it do to worry about these things now? But that, I'm sure all the other people in combat have the same experiences. It bugs you that you can't get it out of your head sometimes. But all in all, I'm thankful for all the things that I've done and been a part of, and especially with personnel I was around. We had a great bunch of military people and officers, and so that's why we came out of this thing as well as we did.
Well, and I'm glad you shared what you just did, because so many veterans have experienced that, have experienced the nightmares and nightmares for decades and decades. My grandfather, who had similar experiences to yours, certainly suffered from those, and many veterans today still have flashbacks or nightmares or trouble sleeping because of what they witnessed during World War II. And hopefully talking about some of these things can be a little therapeutic in some cases. In terms of your own experience, you mentioned some of the other decorations you received, so we know this isn't the only exciting thing that happened for you during World War II. But I imagine nothing was more exciting than having that war come to an end and be able to take all those letters back with you and see the person who wrote them to you.
That's correct. It was a great day when the war was over. But I had a lot of other experiences, too, that one that stands out is when I was in Stavelo, I took care of a lot of wounded that came down from the big battle up above. I forget the name of it, but it's an occasion where the Germans came across with the white flag on their gun, and they wanted to talk to our colonel, and wanted us to give up, and or they were going to kill him. And the colonel said, "Nuts." I'm sure everybody remembers that epitaph. Well, in my occasion when I was in Stavelot, I set up my camp, my medical. I had a fellow with me called Maggot. He was from Kentucky. And Maggot, I called him Maggot. He would always go off, and he did a good job with the wounded people. But I was down in a basement living with two older women, I'd say probably in their 40s, and a couple of little children. And I took my Red Cross deal, and I stuck it on the brick wall outside so that they knew where I was at. If they had anybody that was hurt, they'd send them to me. And on this occasion, one morning, I always got up and got my coffee cup, and they had that ersatz coffee. It's that imitation coffee. But I got so I liked it. But it had a fountain there. All their little towns have a fountain where you drive in. It's a circle, and it goes back out again. Well, there was a faucet there, and there was always water running. There was no way to turn it off. I don't know why it was there. But anyway, I was on this occasion. The old man, he was probably in his 50s. I thought he was really ancient. He went out ahead of me, and he was going to be good and get me some water. I heard his daughter screaming, and she hollering for the doctor. So I ran up there, and she says, "They shot my father." And I said, "Where is he?" He said, "She's by the fountain." So I looked out there, and I looked up and down the street. I couldn't see anybody. She says, "Save him, save him. Help him, help him." Because he was kicking, and his arms were flying around. So I ran across as fast as I could and got behind this parapet wall where that fountain is. And I looked at him. I knew he wasn't going to live very long. I grabbed his leg and ran as fast as I could, pulled like I could pull him across the sidewalk back to the stairs going back down into the basement. She says, "Do something. Get him. Put him out of it. Get him. He is hurt. He is crying. He is hurt. He's pain. Fix him up. Fix him up." So I took out some morphine, and I didn't even take his jacket down. I just shot it right through his arm, and he just relaxed. And she says, "Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you." She didn't know that I just killed him. I just put him out of his misery. And that kind of bothered me, too, on occasions.
The things you have to do, the decisions you're forced to make in a split second in times of war. And I think we can all understand why that still sticks with you all these years later. I asked you about the war being over. Do you remember what that reunion with Virginia was like? And is it safe to say you probably had a few days where you thought that day might never come?
When I actually got home, I didn't tell her I was coming home. I always kind of surprised people. And so I really didn't know how I'd get home. And I don't know how I got a flight, but I got a flight as we were flying over the ranch house of my father and mother-in-law's, and that's where Virginia was. I had written a letter, and I told her approximately when we would be shipping out. You never knew in the military when you were going home. Except that in those days, they came out with a factor of whoever had the most points got to go home first. Well, the fact that I was married, I got 12 points. I had these ribbons and these medals. All those added up, and I had the largest number of anybody in our battalion. So I was one of the first ones that shipped out. And when I got to New York, from there, I got a airplane flight through the military some way. And it wound up over the top of their home over on Gettysburg and DeWolf. I told him, the pilot, I said, "Just right over top of my home." And he said, "You want to talk to him?" I said, "Yeah, let me talk to him." So he called him up. It was about 2 in the morning, and Virginia answered it. I didn't know that was such a big episode, but I remember it as being just tremendously important. She was the light of my life, and I still love her.
Well, and obviously the time is short in the program, but I've mentioned a couple times that you went on to become a chiropractor and serve patients around the valley for years and years, finally retiring at the age of 71. You're 88 now, and I know you have many years left to remember these great memories and continue serving our community. I want to go back to the desert. Now, I know we're jumping around here. But I don't think too many people have heard about the United States using a weapon of 13 million candle power light to blind German forces. The secret strobe light weapons of World War II. And I guess the ones that you worked with were, they were called CDL tanks, Canal Defense Light. What I'm curious, you talked about being out in the desert and you wait until night, obviously, to use this. I'm sure there are some UFO sightings when you were doing this. But what did it look like when you were there and you witnessed these weapons being tested? I mean, how bright are we talking?
Well, that's a good point. When I was drafted, I was working in the shipyards, and I would get flashes from people welding around me. When you get a flash from a welder's arc, it blinds you, and you have to go in. They have to give you medication to get so you see again. Well, this is about the same type of a situation. When I was designated as being the enemy, I had to help out in that dark as a realistic occasion in the future. My fear was that I don't want that light in my eyes because it's liable to give me a flash like I got from the welder's arc. So I at least kept my head down, but a lot of the other fellows didn't know about this, and they would get those flashes and it blinds you. It's a 13 million candle power light. It's a lamp-like deal, and it goes up, the shutter goes up and down. It's an eerie sight when you're down. If you're the enemy and you're laying out there on the ground, it would frighten you, that's for sure. And maybe you would get up and run, but I just laid flat and stayed there and kept my eyes down. And any kind of an injury then during that episode, then I would take care of the people who got hurt, whatever kind of injury they received, diving into the ground. There's a lot of gravel in the desert. There's a lot of thorny plants. There's all kinds of things that get you, but it was an occasion that I didn't want to go through, and I think it has affected my vision, my left eye. They say I have cancer in my left eye now. It may be a contributing factor along with the welding arcs and the other things that have happened to my eye.
And I guess this was never really deployed to any success, but the idea was that this flickering, incredibly bright light is going to disorient and temporarily disable the enemy to give American troops an advantage. Is that what it was in a nutshell?
That's correct. That's what they expected it to do, and probably we were really preparing for Africa. And Africa was finished by the time we got overseas. So the British took it back. They kind of looked at it as it would work. And I understand that they tried it, and the enemy didn't get up and run. They stayed in their foxholes. After the tanks went by, the infantry were on the back of the tanks. And so the Germans were jumping up after they went past and shooting our infantry off of the tanks. This is just what I've heard. But I've read later on that it never was fully used in combat for whatever reason. But it was really built for the desert type of warfare, not in snow and the terrain in Europe. So that's why they didn't use it.
And speaking of the snow, you were so busy telling us about the events of your experiences at Malmedy and during the Battle of the Bulge. You didn't tell us how cold it was. And I imagine for a guy who grew up in Fresno, it had to be pretty stinking cold.
Yes, it's a different terrain entirely than Fresno. But we were in the desert. That was completely different, 120 degrees. I'd just soon have snow as I would 120 degrees of heat. But I was very fortunate. I didn't have a foxhole to dig. I didn't have to dig into that ice like the infantry did. I had my half track. I had my bedroll made. I slept in that. I had my food in there. I had K rations. I lived like a general compared to the guys that were in the, these people were, I hate to say this, but some of these people were urinating on their feet so that they would get frostbitten and they could lose a foot. It's not pleasant to be in a situation where you have to do that. But it occurred. I had episodes where I had to take care of people with frostbitten feet and things that just terrible, painful things for them. I'm just thankful that I came out of it as well as I did. And my memory is good about the war. I don't have any bad feelings about any of it. Anything that's happened to me has been for a purpose.
What do you think that purpose is? I mean, how do you add all this up when you see the things that could have happened to you that didn't? You see that all that you survived throughout the war and that you're still around at 88 and feeling as good as you do. How do you add all that up?
Well, one of the things that helps me is that my grandparents lived to be 97 and 96, three of them. I have the DNA in me that if I don't get hit real hard or shot or something, I figure I'm going to be around as long as they lived. We got better hospital medication now than they had when they were alive. So that helps me. And the fact that I've had these experiences just has, in my own mind's eye, it has affirmed the fact that there's somebody else helping me, just like he has throughout all my life. And I just leave it up to him to keep helping me and helping my family to keep me healthy so that I can continue to enjoy my children, my grandchildren. I've got 30-some grandchildren. I don't know how many great-grandchildren. I'm just blessed with so much good in my family. I just cannot explain to anybody else how I feel about all of my family.
You ever realize that all those dozens of grandchildren and great-grandchildren would have never been born if you weren't ready to speak a little German in December of 44?
That's true. I had an occasion just 2 weeks ago when 8 of my grandchildren came in from out of San Francisco to surprise Grandpa and brought food. We had a time, and they were asking me about my war experiences. That's how some of this comes about. They all love their grandpa. They all love me, and they tell me I love all of them. And I make it clear to them that I'm happy to be their grandfather.
Well, and I'm happy to have shared this time with you today. I'm sorry that we're out of time, because I'm sure you have many more stories, and hopefully you'll keep telling them. Dr. E.J. Leatherman of Clovis, California, has been our guest today. To see some pictures of him and learn more about his story and some of the things his outfit did in World War II, go to our website at kmjnow.com or check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook. Bulldog football is coming up next from Lincoln, Nebraska, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. If you're listening online here, you may have noticed lately that sometimes our podcast versions have a little more material than what you hear on the radio. Every once in a while, we can't fit it all into the time constraints of Hometown Heroes. But on the web, why not include every little thing that was said, just like I do on all the CDs that I give the veterans each week? Every little word in our conversation, usually every pause or or hesitation, is there too. And after we finished our interview, Dr. Leatherman wanted to add a few words about somebody that he called the bravest man he ever saw. So here's a little bonus story for you.
He was, he was brave or he was crazy. It's times when I was in Stavelo, in that cellar. I heard him, one of our tanks was firing right down the street from me. So I hustled down there and I got behind the tank. And this tank driver would jump the tank out around the building, the brick building, and he'd fire and he'd jump it back. He wasn't driving, he was jumping it. I never saw anybody treat a tank like that, but he was afraid one of those Tiger Royals would get him because they had one across the river that could have got him. So anyway, he hit a blank wall. Our wall that was blank to me, it was out of concrete, and knocked it over, and we watched, and pretty soon they came out with a white flag deal, and the Germans came out. Well, it was quite a bit of time was in before they came out of there, but anyway, that's what happened to wound them. So when they came out, they had a medic. He had bandaged this officer up, and he had him in a wheelbarrow. It was a wooden wheelbarrow, and the guy had one leg gone, one arm gone. He had bandage all over his head. He was just a mess. Anyway, he was a captain, SS captain. And so when I went over there to see, I checked, and I said, man, that medic did a good job on this guy. And so up in the second floor, I saw these guys, I'd seen them before up there, buddies, and one of them, he came down, he said, USOB, he said, I'm going to shoot you in the head. And he got right down and he was cussing him, and this captain spit right in his face. And I thought, my God, what is wrong with this guy? And so this officer, he was built by like you, a big, heavy, nice, good-looking kid, he says, you don't have to doctor him anymore, Doc. He says, I'll take care of him. So he said he shot my buddy on the second floor up there. And he said, I'm not leaving here until I take care of this guy. So he took the wheelbarrow and he went down the trail, went right past where my medical equipment was kept, went down the trail there, and we heard this bang, bang, and nobody said anything, and that was the end of it. So, but that was, I couldn't believe anybody would do that, but that's what this guy did. Those SS people were, they were treacherous.